As you have probably noticed, we talk a lot about the opportunities for the next 10 years, but there are also risks, obviously, risks that could jeopardize all our good intentions for the next decade. The next person on this stage was appointed the first director of Oxford University's new think tank com research center, the 21st Century School. Ian Golden is originally from South Africa. He fought against apartheid, and once that struggle had been won, he was advisor to President Mandela in the battle, when the battle had been won. Development advisor, sorry, that was what I wanted to say. He's a former vice president of the World Bank, and he's here to talk about the risks that we're facing and the not so positive domino effects that might occur if we don't think carefully. Please welcome Ian Golden.
Good afternoon, and thank you for having me to share thoughts with you about the future. I represent the Oxford Martin School, which is about 300 people working across the university on the big challenges of our time. And what I want to emphasize is not only that this will be a time of the most extraordinary opportunity, but also risk. We can't predict the future, and if we try to, we will be as out of step as the leaders of great technology companies, as the political pundits and intelligence agencies, and of course, as those of my colleagues, and I'm an economist, 20,000 of us with PhDs from great institutions that failed to see the financial crisis coming. So we cannot predict the future, but we do need to begin to understand it, and particularly understand this extraordinary period that we're living in. A period unlike that ever in the history of humanity. This is the period of turbocharged globalization. This is the period of super connectivity. The world is more connected physically and virtually than ever before in humanity. And this brings enormous opportunity. It will be the best era ever. It will be the era of the greatest innovations ever. This next 10, 20 years. But the underside of this is risk, and I want to talk both about some of the opportunities and how these very opportunities carry with them risk. And what you see in this graphic is that although we've increased the population of the planet by about 2 billion over the last 20 or so years, income growth has grown faster than population growth for the first time since 1,000 years ago. It's a period like the period of about 1,000 years ago of Renaissance, of the coming together of people, then of Islamic and Christian civilizations, of great inventions from China and India coming into Europe, and vice versa, of voyages of discovery and new ideas, leapfrogging that had taken civilization generations to establish in certain localities, now coming to other places. And that has been the story since the fall of the Berlin Wall, since the opening up of China, since the creation of the Maastricht Treaty, since the ending of dictatorships in over 64 countries in the world over the last 20 or so years, including my own country, South Africa. A new integration at the political level, economic level, and ideological level, facilitated by technologies like fiber optics. So this is a different period. This is a period, and I'll just show some illustrations. These are capital flows, and you see how to about 1990, they were relatively stable, and since then, all the capital flows, these are the flows of foreign investment, migrant workers sending back aid, and bond and equity flows. Very unstable, but at different orders of magnitude to previous periods. And if you look at indices of openness and integration, you see a similar story. These are indices of restrictiveness going down, openness going up for both the rich and the developing countries. And this is true in all areas, not just in economics. If you measure how long it takes for someone to get to a big city, the areas in yellow are less than 2 hours from a major city of the world. Two-thirds of the world's population now connected, and of course increasing geographical concentration. difficult to see this graph perhaps, but this is the relationship between income and urbanization. Over half the planet urbanized now. Physical proximity, and this physical proximity leading to income growth. It's not that income growth leads to proximity, it is the other way around. Proximity brings new innovation. When people with ideas come together in contact with markets, with capital, with others with ideas, and spark a virtuous circle. And this is both physical and, of course, now on the internet. So it's a period in which life expectancy has increased by about 20 years on average. It took from the Stone Age to this period to get a 20-year average increase in life expectancy. It's a period where illiteracy, the number of people that can read and write, has gone down by about a half, from about half to a quarter of the world's planet, and where the number of very poor people living under a dollar a day has gone down by about 300 million, despite the world's population going up by about 2 billion. So a most phenomenal time, the best time ever to be alive. There are two underbellies to this connectivity, to this turbocharged globalization. The one is inequality and growing inequality, and I will not dwell on that now, but it's a vital issue. The second, which I want to focus on more, is systemic risk. The extent to which closer proximity, physically and virtually, leads to the spreading more rapidly, not only of bad ideas, but also bad things, like pathogens, as described in this graphic. Let me come to that briefly by first looking at the major projections for the future. What's remarkable about these UN projections to only 2050 is the range of uncertainty of 4 billion people looking out. That's about two-thirds of the current population of the planet. And you'll know from Aubrey that you just heard that this is both about how long people live, but also how many people will be born. The story on life expectancy, notwithstanding the radical changes that Aubrey spoke to, is of steady improvements of about 2 years, a bit decades. So while you're here for the 24 hours, one of the many things this conference will bring you is a 40-minute improvement in your life expectancy. And that's both because of the things you'll learn which will change your bad habits, stop you smoking, stop you doing silly things, but also because while you're here, people are in laboratories around the world inventing things that will make you live longer. And this is converging around the world, and it might well be conservative. The more radical story than increased life expectancy, though, is a rapid decline in fertility. And this will pose new risks. So the whole world will go below replacement level, except Africa, over this period, with dramatic declines in fertility. When people become richer, become urbanized, when women get jobs, and I hope they do, as the previous speaker has indicated, they have less and less children. What happens in this transformation is we have to erase our mental images of population pyramids and put in their place visions of population coffins. The pressure is on the youth, who will have to support a growing, aging population, will grow and grow. The youth will lose power in this period up to over 2020. They will be frustrated. The elderly will stay on with their jobs. Retirement will be abolished. Pensions will be greatly reduced or abolished. Both private sector and public sector are not sustainable. So people will have to work longer. They will be healthier. They will work longer. They'll want to work longer, and they'll have to. Not only in Italy, but around the world. This is a global phenomenon, changing demographic nature. The assets will move to the elderly. The elderly will hold the money. They will hold the political power because they will be the majority, the elderly. So the age of youth is giving way to an elder population. And of course, the frustration of the youth will grow around the world. But part of this process, as kids, the number of kids people have, the number of children people have radically declines, is also major gender imbalances, and that's a new risk. Note in this, if you can see in these bottom cohorts in China, 20 million more young boys than girls. If people are only having one child and they're in sexist societies and the technologies allow, which they do now, they will choose to have a boy. And so it's absolutely essential societies reward girls, reward women, give them the same status, the same opportunity as boys. Otherwise, we will be in a vicious circle of increasing gender imbalances, particularly at the younger cohorts. And this is already happening. Provinces of China, 1.3 boys to every young girl. And you can imagine the social consequences as well as the implications for fertility going forward. So dramatically important reasons why we need to think about gender, not just for this. The future will also be much older. 700 million people over the age of 65 in Asia. Rapid growth everywhere, including here. But the sheer numbers in Asia, as always, overwhelming. Many of you from business, the business implications are obvious. Can migration take up some of the slack? And I've been working a lot on this and I've got a book coming out shortly on this issue. Even if the number of migrants were to be 5 times their current levels, as the workforce in the rich countries goes down from about 800 million to 600 million, they couldn't meet this gap. But we will be changing our views about migration. We will be searching for migrants, not just skilled, who we will understand as key drivers of our economy, of our innovation, but also unskilled, who we'll need to push us around in our wheelchairs and to keep our streets clean. So their views of migration will change radically. Of course, the demographic change in the countries the migrants are coming from and their growth rates is even more rapid than ours. And so the big question is, where will they come from? They certainly are unlikely to come from the societies we now see. And this is because economic growth towards 2020 is likely to be very much like it is now. We in the rich countries failed to listen to the lessons we were teaching the world. We were talking about macro balance, we were talking about prudent policies, and we were abusing our own advice. And so the prospects for the developing countries are even stronger now than they were prior to the economic crisis relative to our own. So China will continue to double its income every 10 years or so, India a little bit behind, and the weight of balance rapidly moving towards the east, with China becoming the biggest economy around this period. Let me move from some of the mega social trends to the technology trends and then talk about risk and just focus on a few of these. Behind the technology story is the continuing power of Moore's Law. Moore in 1965 talking about the power to double processing speed every 2 years. He thought it would end after 3 generations, as we've seen. It's going to continue, and if you speak to leading computer scientists, they will tell you at least another 20 years. Doubling every year for the same price. This means we will continue to see 1 million times improvement for the same price every 25 years or so in the capacity. What do you do with this capacity? Well, clearly the information Big Bang is part of this process. And by 2020, there will be more information digitally added onto the internet every hour than all that every year now, which is already every year, all the words ever written and spoken in history. This is going to continue at this enormous growth rate. And the capacity to manage it technically appears to be there. So we have this extraordinary potential coming out of computers to do much more faster. The future will also be very small. This is a dust mite, invisible, of course, on a mock-up of a machine. This is the real thing. This is a nano syringe going through a cell membrane in our nanomedicine lab in Oxford. There are a number of important things about this. The first is dimensions. This happened in 44 billionths of a second, what you watched. The scale is 10 billionths of a meter. This is invisible in time. It's invisible to watch except with atomic microscopy. But it's also important to understand in this something else I'd like to say about the future of technology and our use of it, which is we don't really understand the consequences. Notice that this nano needle made out of carbon fiber, which we're developing in order to take cancer drugs to cancer stem cells, invisibly driven through the body. Extremely powerful potential cures. But notice that it takes with it a piece of the cell membrane with it. So we're trying to understand these technologies. We're trying to understand whether we need new regulatory environments for them. whether there are unintended consequences of these, as there have been in the development historically of the atom and of many, many other things. It's taken us 200 years to recognize that carbon has an atmospheric price and will lead to climate change. It took us a long time to realize the implications of asbestos. We're trying to ensure that as we speed up technological development, there are not more terrible surprises that come beyond it. This is a different sort of wonder. This is an embryonic stem cell created from nothing, a single cell, that can be directed towards any part of the body, and this is in our Stem Cell Institute in the Oxford Martin School. This is extraordinarily powerful. It can lead to the regeneration of different parts of the body. This is a heart muscle. But we don't understand yet crucial things, like how will they be available, who will they be available to. This is even more powerful, perhaps. In the back is a wild mouse. In the front is a slightly genetically modified mouse. Note that the wild mouse gets tired after about 200 meters. The mouse in the front is a very happy mouse. It reproduces to our equivalent of 85 years. But it also goes for 2 kilometers, about 10 times the distance of the wild mouse. They are enormously powerful potential technologies being developed, which will begin to be around in 2020. But there's no regulatory environment for them, and we don't know whether they'll only be available to the rich, whether we're risking a new eugenics race, where the rich can buy new technologies, which will enhance them mentally, physically. Of course, will these be available in Africa and in England? I'm not sure about Denmark. The National Health Service doesn't look like it'll have the finance for this. So the question is, as we develop these new technologies, how do we ensure that we harness their benefits and build resilience against the risks and also think about the broader social implications? We are moving into an age where the risks we face increasingly are anthropogenic, caused by ourselves, rather than some which are natural, and of course the Icelandic volcano was such. The problem in understanding this new risk is we don't understand the data. What the financial crisis showed us is it wasn't the absence of data. There's more data in finance, there's more capacity to manage finance, there are better institutions in finance, there are more global regulators than any other sector in the world has ever had. And yet all of us were blind to what was happening. It's not the absence of data. It's our failure to understand the speed of change of the world and of technologies, in this case, the derivatives and other instruments that were being developed that underlay the transactions. And the failure of the imagination to do things which now seem obvious, like look at gross transactions rather than net, aggregate at the global level rather than the national level, and other things like that. It seems obvious afterwards, but will we be able to see the next one coming? And I doubt it. So our old systems are no good. We need to think as part of a globally connected society. We need to think of this issue of superconnectivity and systemic risk, and that the shocks will come from surprising places and not the old ones. We need to build resilience. We need to see assets as being stocks as well. They're not just a liability, whether they're on our balance sheet or whether they are our stocks of spare oxygen in our hospitals or food in our warehouses. We need to build resilience in systems. We cannot rely on perceptions. This is from the World Economic Forum, which I've been going to for the last 15 years. You ask people what the risks are, you ask the risk managers what the risks are, and then you tell them what the risks are. This is like reading yesterday's newspaper. It's not worth anything. You can draw impact probability maps, as the insurance industry does, as I do for fun, with anything. The problem is the long tail. The long tail is wagging more and more aggressively. These very low probability, high impact events. More and more so because of this connectivity, because things will start in one place which have no connection to your business or your society and bring it down. This is the period where we worry about most existential risk, the risks that will destroy the planet. The failure of collective action, and we've seen this in the North Atlantic off the coast here, the collapse of cod fishing. What every fisherman does is rational. Perhaps even what some governments do in subsidizing those fishermen is rational, although I don't think so. But collectively, it's a disaster. The economic incentives and the individual incentives are not aligned with the global needs. And we see that, of course, dramatically with climate change. This is a project I worked on when I was vice president at the bank and before. This is the Aral Sea, which you know was a sea shared by 8 countries in the former Soviet Union. And you can see that the work we did wasn't very effective. Every country was doing the rational thing, pulling out irrigation water. That was the end of the ocean. This is a happier experience. This is, of course, the Straits of Gibraltar and Metap. At the same time as the Aral Sea collapsed, the Mediterranean was saved. The combination of science, scientific knowledge, dissemination of that, and public action with politics and policy coordination saved the Mediterranean. It can be done. Can it be done for climate change? Too little, too late is what is happening. And so I'm very pessimistic in the top end of the spectrum. It's a huge task to bring the per capita use of everyone down to 2 tons per capita. It will require a complete retooling of not only our own economies in the rich countries, but more worryingly, across the world. We cannot say to developing countries, sorry, the atmosphere is full, you can't get yourself a car or a fridge or a development prospect. So we have to think of new solutions. They do exist. We've developed a car that can do about 5,000 miles per gallon. Sorry, I need to do the conversion to kilometers. The problem is dimensionality still. But the technology is not the obstacle. The obstacle is getting society to adopt in time these new technologies. Just moving to another systemic risk from climate change, which is pandemics. What we don't recognize is that this has always been the biggest killer of humanity. We fail to recognize this at our peril. It will continue to be in the future unless we build resilience. And adding to the old risks of natural pathogens is a very scary new risk, which is of bioterrorism, of biopathogens or bioaccidents. Because with the cost of DNA synthesizing coming down at the same exponential rate that computer power is increasing, you will be able to synthesize new strains for maybe €1,000. And of course, if you can produce your own versions of Ebola or smallpox and other things, you can kill hundreds of millions of people if you have the dissemination methods. So how do you maintain this new power? The future of the world, as we've seen in the destruction of internet systems, as in reputational risk, and as we may see in biopathogens, is increased power of the individual. Nation states increasingly will have less and less power. And conflicts between nation states are likely to be a far smaller risk in the future than the risks posed by single individuals or the collective failure of our adding up of individual action, as in climate change and in other areas of resource depletion. So we need to manage at the global level, and we need to manage at the individual level going forward. We see this bizarre circumstance of the return of piracy, which we thought was outlawed hundreds of years ago. Piracy, small groups of individuals capturing the nodes of globalization, finding the choke points and choking the system. And we see this, of course, in shipping, but we see it on the internet and we see it in other areas. So we need to understand what the weak points in globalization are. We need to ensure that we manage the systemic risk. Because if we don't manage the systemic risk associated with globalization, if we don't ensure that globalization brings benefits to all and that the shocks that it transmits are not so severe that our society is on a lower growth path, people will rebel against globalization. People will say, let's be protectionist, let's put up our barriers, let's be xenophobic, let's keep out the migrants, let's try and keep out diseases, let's try and close our finance systems down, become less globalized. This, of course, would be a disaster for the world. This would slow growth and opportunity. But it's the risk that comes from our failure to understand systemic risk. The future is increasingly intense connectivity. We need to understand that the global governance system that we have is not fit for purpose. These institutions were not built to manage a super-connected world. As we've seen with the financial crisis, the IMF, which is the strongest of these institutions, the BIS, not far from here, didn't see it coming. So we cannot rely on them. I think we also have to recognize that despite the super improvement in speed of processing, in education, we haven't become much wiser. We need to think and think again and connect to new ways of doing things. And I think we can take great hope that the new generation, the innovators around the world, will ensure that the pace of innovation is even greater. Genius is being unlocked every minute, every day from around the world. What globalization brings is individuals from around the world who've never been educated before, who've never been connected before, to commonly attack this problem that we face. So we can be optimistic about solutions, but before we can find the solutions, we have to understand the problems. By doing so, we can all look forward to a very happy and good elderly age, even if we are cloned. Thank you.
Just a few quick questions. Humanity is always adapted. We've seen challenges before, there have been risks before, but we have also been able to adapt. Are you sure we won't do that this time?
Oh, I think we'll adapt. I think humanity will survive. You know, we've been through periods before when there were only 1,000 people or so left on the planet, like we know them. The thing is not to kill or not to have killed very large numbers of people. The thing is to ensure that we are able to use this extraordinary potential we have now of connectivity around the world, of economic opportunity, to bring the best for everyone.
So you do also see it as an opportunity?
I hope that I was clear that I see globalization as the greatest opportunity ever created for humanity. This is the best time to be alive, but it's also the most dangerous. And it's understanding those two things and it's managing the danger that's, I think, the importance. If humanity was in a dismal situation, I think we'd worry less, but it is an extraordinary thing, and we could reach an age of eco-affluence where we're very happy, if we can manage these risks.
You talk about that we have to think as a global society. You mentioned how these governing organizations were not fit, actually, to tackle the situation we're in. But do you see, then, any signs of this changing? Are political leaders around the world becoming more aware that they have to change the way that they work together?
That's a very difficult question. I think if one looks at the institutions and you look at the political leadership, we're in a bad place at the moment. The institutions are only as strong as the leaders will allow them to be. They are owned by the global political leadership. I worked in a number of them and saw that very clearly. And the global political leadership is in a dangerous space. The US is giving up power to China. China doesn't really want power or can't take power now. Europe's got its own problems to deal with, and the rest of the emerging markets aren't strong enough yet. So I think it's a very dangerous time to be facing these problems. That's why increasingly I believe in the power of business to connect and do things, and the power of citizens. And you see this in actions on many, many areas. I don't think we can wait for the institutions or the political leadership to do it. We have to force them to do it or do it ourselves.
Thank you for talking to us.
Thank you.
Thank you, Ian Golden.